All right. We're going to continue with our study in the Old Testament. Ben has, for the last 2 months, covered the book of Genesis, and our kind of our objective, as Bob and Dwayne have laid out for us this year, is that we want to go through the Old Testament and have a particular lens as we look at it for application to our lives as Christians today. How can we learn from the Old Testament in 2020 for each of us? So Ben laid out Genesis. My objective over the next 2 months is to cover Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua. So 5 books in 9 weeks. One of the other assignments that the elders laid out is they wanted each of the teachers that were assigned topics to try to identify ways to provide some mentoring to other developing Christians. And so I will be out in a couple weeks, and I'll need to work with somebody to help take class for me and use that as part of the mentoring process. So to begin with, today what I'd like to do is cover Exodus and just take the first half of it, and next week we'll do another lesson in Exodus. So 2 weeks for the book of Exodus, because I think it's super interesting and there's a lot of application to our lives. And so where I'd like to divide the book of Exodus is from chapter 1 all the way through really to the giving of the law. And then the second week, what I'd like to look at is the tabernacle and all the furnishings and everything inside and how that relates to our worship today. So again, we're going to cover Exodus today. We're just going to look at what I'll call the first half, everything up to the giving of the law. So a little bit of trivia in our class today. Everybody knows what the word Exodus means, correct? Exit. A way out is what it means in the Greek. And when we think about a way out, whose way out specifically in the book of Exodus? And why?
They were being enslaved, and God heard their cries of needing help. He decided to get them out.
Okay, so that's the first thing. So what's the first spiritual implication that we find right off the bat then? How does that relate? What does the children of Israel being in slavery have to do with us today?
Well, we would be slaves to sin.
Okay.
So a way of escape from death for us.
Okay, spiritual slavery to sin and physical slavery. That's the comparison. I think that's the theme that we've got to keep in mind as we look at Exodus and make application to our life. It all started with that. Subject to it. And so the Exodus is this historical picture of God redeeming and saving His people. Did God have to do that? Did God have to come in and save His children?
God sovereign, he can do whatever he wants to.
Okay.
Well, if he was going to, in a way he did, because of the promise that he had made to Abraham.
Okay.
And if he was going to keep that promise, then he had to. He's going to make a great nation out of them and all of those other promises that he made.
So we're going to hear a lot of this over the next few months. As we go through an election, everybody makes promises, but who is the one person that always keeps his promise? That's God. And so he told Abraham in Genesis chapter 12, I promise you that I will make you a great nation. And I will bless you. You'll be innumerable. How many children of Israel were there at this time, approximately?
Well, there was, you mean when they left?
Yeah, when they left Egypt.
There was, I think, over 600,000, what they would call men of war, or able to draw the sword. So, yeah, probably.
From what I've read in different places, most people estimate that there are about 2 million people So here's the other thing we need to keep in mind is there's this reconstitution of the children of Israel in the book of Exodus. So God makes this promise to Abraham, and we've got Isaac, and we've got Jacob, we've got these 12 that are going to lead this, but are they a nation? Are they really a nation of people at this time when they're living in Egypt?
It's really a group of slaves.
Yeah, they're just a huge mass of slaves that are interconnected by marriage and birth. What are they missing? What else did God promise?
A leader.
A leader. Okay, they're missing a leader. What else are they missing?
They didn't have their own country.
Yeah, they didn't. They weren't a sovereign nation. And so if God was going to bless them and give them all of these wonderful things that He promised Abraham, what did they have to have? They had to have a land to call their own. Any other connections here to the spiritual world today? What kind of promises has God made to us? What promise did Christ make to each of us about a future dwelling place?
John 14, I'm going to prepare a place for you.
Yep. So He makes a promise. If it were not so, I wouldn't have told you. And so He goes to prepare this. So this is God keeping His promise. Could somebody read 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 6 through 8? Actually, I might go through 6 through 11. 1 Corinthians 10, 6 through 11. Read that whenever somebody's got it.
These things became our examples, to the intent that we should not lust after evil things, as they also lusted. But do not become idolaters as were some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Nor let us commit sexual immorality as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 fell. Nor let us tempt Christ as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by serpents. Nor complain as some of them also complained and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come.
All right, so here we have the writing where Exodus is being documented to show us God's way of delivering sinful people, is really what this boils down to. And as I tried to think about, there's a lot of themes we could pick, but if there's three key themes in the book of Exodus, what comes to your mind? Here's the first one that I have. Deliverance. What are some ones that you can think of? Key themes. Yeah, you could call it redemption. You could probably put in salvation in that area too. I'm thinking really big, thematic.
Maybe the law.
Okay, so I had that as number three, and I called it covenant. What's the other really big theme? And maybe you've got more, but I had three.
I'm sticking to hope, but I don't know if that's...
Okay, I would put that in the top one. Salvation, deliverance.
Subjection, maybe?
I lump that in the other with there as well. Here's the other one that I put. Worship. There's a lot, and we'll cover this next week, but whenever we have the temple built and all these sacrifices and all these other things that are contained, and as we get into the other books, God's laying the foundation for how He wants His people to worship Him. And He gets into quite a bit of detail through that. There's another thing that I'd like to spend some time on today. In addition to some of these key themes, the story is a lot about the children of Israel and their deliverer, Moses, but who's the story really about?
God.
Yeah, it's God. So we learn a lot about the nature and the characteristic of God in the book of Exodus. What do we find out about God? Because in the book of Genesis, we have these illusions. We have him with Adam and Eve. We've got him talking to Abraham. But we still don't know a lot about him or what he wants, what he desires. What do we find out about God in the book of Exodus?
Well, the laws, I mean, we get into the commandments, right? So.
Okay. So what he expects?
Yeah.
Power.
Oh, all right. So what are the big things that you think of in Exodus that show forth the power of God, Matt?
Well, we have the plagues.
Okay.
We have the parting of the Red Sea. And
those are the two biggest ones that I can think of. The 10 plagues, the parting of the Red Sea.
Manna.
God feeds his people as well. Linda, did you have one? Precise. Okay, so we have these detailed instructions like you need to sacrifice goat A on day 34.2. And it's got to be done that way. Otherwise, if you don't, what happens?
You die.
You die. You die. He's very specific. Okay, what else do we find out about God?
He was in the pillar of cloud and fire.
All right. What about his name? So what comes up in Exodus that we find out about God's name and what that means? And what is his name?
Well, the name that he gave Moses to tell the children of Israel is that I am, meaning that he always has been and he always will be eternal.
Okay. So that tells us a lot about the nature of God. He has always been and always will be. What else do we find out about his name? He says it in this particular passage. When does that occur, that he's talking to Moses and he actually says, okay, when all these people, when Pharaoh asked me who sent me and when the children of Israel want to know whose authority I've got, I want you to say this. How does God respond?
You tell them that I am sent you.
Okay. Let's turn there. It's Exodus chapter 3. And somebody read Exodus 3, 13 through 15.
Then Moses said to God, indeed, when I come to the children of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they say to me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? And God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, thus you shall say to the children of Israel, I am, has sent me to you. Moreover, God said to Moses, thus you shall say to the children of Israel, the Lord God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial to all generations. All
right, so he gives him information about who he is, but then he also gives his name, and he uses the Lord, that's the Yahweh, that the children of Israel wouldn't even pronounce because they didn't want to accidentally say his name in vain, so they abbreviated that as Yahweh. And so we find out about God's name in Exodus. Any other major theme? The last one I had here, I want to put down Moses. So we find out a lot about God, but we also find out about Moses and his leadership. So he spent 40 years, his first 40 years of his life, thinking that he was somebody pretty important. And then the next 40 years, he learned that he was really nobody. And the last 40 years of his life, he spent discovering that God can make nobody a somebody. He was a somebody, a nobody, and in the last 40 years, seeing how God, what God could do with a nobody. So, those are the main things that I wanted to cover. I'll erase this. So, the first topic for a few minutes, what I want to get into now is the making of a nation. So we talked about that God had promised to Abraham that he would make him a nation, but they lacked the land, they lacked the wherewithal and the resources to become that nation. And so, to me, that is all about God keeping his promise. When do you think that the children of Israel actually considered themselves free? At what point were they...
Probably after they saw the Egyptian army drowned in the Red Sea.
Okay.
They weren't happy, really, but they were free from Egypt.
Okay, they were free from slavery, but were they really still free? Because what did they spend the next 40 years doing?
Wandering.
Yeah, they were free, but they didn't have a home and they wandered. And why was that?
Disobedience.
Okay, so we can be free physically, but not free spiritually. And that's kind of the state that they existed for 40 years. So there's a lot of work that we have to do as well. So did this Exodus theme of salvation or deliverance, we talked about it being from physical bondage in Egypt that corresponded to our spiritual bondage as well. Somebody read John 8, 34 and 36, or excuse me, John 8, 34 through 36. And somebody read Romans 6, 6, 6, 17 and 6, 20. John 8, 34 through 36.
Jesus answered them, "Most assuredly I say to you, whoever commits sin is a slave of sin, and a slave does not abide in the house forever, but a son abides forever. Therefore, if the Son makes you free, you shall be free indeed. I know that you are Abraham's descendants, but you seek to kill me because my word has no place in you."
And then Romans 6 and verses 6, 17 and 20. Just verses 17 and verse 20.
Verse 6. Knowing that our old man was crucified with him, that the body of sin might be done away with, that we should no longer be slaves of sin. May God be thanked that though you were slaves of sin, yet you obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine to which you were delivered. For when you were slaves of sin, you were free in regards to righteousness.
Okay. So here's the picture that I get in my mind of how this worked. So here's Egypt and all the bondage and physical bondage that they lived in. Moses comes in after the plague and God's power and leads them out. And they come to the Red Sea here. And correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the things that I was reading is that there was basically tall hills, if not bluffs or mountainside, that was up against this side of the bank here. And really, when you came to the river, there was nowhere else to go. You couldn't really go north or south. And so Moses leads approximately 2 million people right here to the boundary of the waters. And coming from behind them is what?
Chariots from Egypt.
Yeah, they're going to be totally slaughtered. Do you think that God intentionally created this environment right here with all these soldiers here behind them who would kill them, or a flood of water where they would drown? They were totally helpless. Is that by design?
Yes, I would say.
I think absolutely. And why did God do this? Why did he put his children that he made promise to in this type of a situation of certain death?
He wants us to absolutely be certain to know that he will deliver them.
Okay, so was it Moses that was going to save them? Was it themselves? What were they going to do? They were going to be totally annihilated, and God puts them into this situation to prove a point that salvation comes because of me first. I decide that I'm going to love you and that I'm going to save you. So what comes first in this process of salvation? Is it something that the children of Israel do, or is it something that God does? And if you were to put a word to it, what word would you use to describe it?
I think trust first.
Okay. I'm going to use this word. To me, it is the grace of God that He creates a way of escape for us. He loves us enough to not allow these things to happen. Now, He parts these waters, and then what has to take place? Somebody said faith after that. So if grace comes first by God making this way, but then it takes action on the behalf of the people to make it across, what passage does that remind you of? Okay. Ephesians 2, chapter 8. If you're not familiar with that. For by grace you have been saved through faith. It's like you're going through the Red Sea walls that have been parted. So if you try to put yourself on the bank of the Red Sea and imagine these waters standing up on either side, do you think it took a little bit of faith to walk in between them?
Yes.
Now, you had some motivation behind you.
Well, but it also took action on their part, all three of them. Each one had to happen or they would have been saved.
Yeah.
Just like we have to. Same as works today. Works along with grace and faith.
Yep. So we can put that one down here. God made the way. The people believed in it, just like Abraham believed the promise of God, and to him it was accounted righteousness. But then Abraham did things. He was going to sacrifice his son. He picked up and left everything, and the children of Israel walked through on dry land. To Matt's point, one of the other things that Exodus does is it demonstrates the absolute power of God over creation. If you go into the book of Psalms and you read about the song that Moses and Miriam sang after they went through the Red Sea, how is it that God parted those waters? It was a great wind that brought them off. But in Psalms, it actually says it was the blast of His nostrils. Basically, the breath that God breathed, that's all it takes for Him to open up a path through the ocean and create deliverance.
That's in Exodus 15.
Exodus 15. All right. So this is kind of, again, it's the whole theme of salvation. God creates a way for us. He does it through power, absolute power. We see that in the 10 plagues that come through. The power is the creator. So you think about as the creator, how many of the plagues underscored God's role as the creator? What were the plagues about? What do you think, Matt?
Well, I was going to say persuasion towards the Egyptians.
Okay, it was persuasion, but what? I mean, each of these plagues, what was in them?
Animals, physical things that God had created.
Yeah, these are all created things. I think it's God just intentionally saying, I want to show you that I made all these things and I control all these things, just like Christ controlled the waters on the Sea of Galilee. Not only was the plagues to be for the Egyptians to prove His power, but it also says that they were to be to their sons and the generations that were come and the children of Israel. Everybody was to know that it was God's power. Okay, so that's kind of... Any other thoughts as far as how Exodus ties to salvation? To me, this was probably the biggest one here.
Passing through the waters kind of represents baptism.
Yep.
Another thing, too, I'm thinking about this because this idea shows up in Romans. I was reading this yesterday. God saved the children of Israel because He wanted to. It wasn't because of their merit. It wasn't because they were especially deserving. It's because He made a promise and He was following through on that promise.
Next thing I'd like to spend a couple minutes talking about is the Passover. So it's in the book of Exodus. We come through these nine plagues, and what is the tenth one that's going to come?
Death of the firstborn.
Death of the firstborn, unless what measures are taken?
The blood over the doorpost.
Okay, you're going to kill this lamb. You're going to take its blood. You're going to put it over the doorpost of your house, and the death angel will pass over you. Exodus was written, and I think God established this whole system of the Passover to point to what?
Jesus.
Yeah, it was there intentionally to point to Jesus and what he would do. A note that I had here, Passover night, the blood was sufficient, but it was not efficient unless it was applied. So we can know about Jesus, but unless we apply him and we take him into our lives, it's not going to create the effect that it's needed. Another thing is we kind of think about that last story of the children of Israel crossing through. That Passover lamb, first thing that they had to do was kill it to take its blood to put it over the doorway. Then what did they have to do with that lamb? Okay, so they didn't just throw it out in the street into the dump. They ate the lamb after they had drained the blood from it to put it over the doorpost. What are we to make of that?
Well, it's a comparison of our communion that we have on the first day of the week, body and blood of our lamb, Jesus Christ. That's a comparison.
Yep. So we are saved by the blood. That Passover lamb is going to, or that death angel will cross over, and we will find salvation in the blood. But then after we've been saved, we have to be nourished and fed. And that's why we eat of that. What did Jesus say in John chapter 6? Anybody remember? Somebody read John 6, 54 through 58.
Body, to drink my blood.
Yeah, that's what the one I was thinking of. John 6, 54 through 58.
Whosoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life, and I will raise him up at the last day. For my flesh is food indeed, and my blood is drink indeed. He who eats my flesh and drinks my blood abides in me, and I in him. As the living Father sent me, and I live because of the Father, so he who feeds on me will live because of me. This is the bread which came down from heaven, not as your fathers ate the manna and are dead. He who eats this bread will live forever.
All right. So here's a couple other passages on this Passover that I wanted to bring out. Somebody, I need three folks to help me read. Exodus 4:22. And then Hosea 11:1, and then Matthew
2:13-15.
This is making the connection with Jesus and him being a son that would come out of Egypt.
Then you shall say to Pharaoh, thus says the Lord, Israel is my son, my firstborn.
Okay, so we find out that Israel is the son of God. What does Hosea prophesy after that, much later? Hosea 11:1.
When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son.
Okay, so Hosea is remembering back to Exodus and saying, I will bring my son, call him out of Egypt, and that was Israel. And then who made the connection in Matthew chapter 2, verse 13 through 15? Let's read that.
Now when they had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream, saying, arise, take the young child and his mother, flee to Egypt, and stay there until I bring you word, for Herod will seek the young child to destroy him. And when he arose, he took the young child and his mother by night and departed for Egypt, and was there until the death of Herod, that it might be fulfilled that was spoken by the Lord through the prophet, saying, out of Egypt I called my son.
So why did Joseph and Mary go to Egypt? Two reasons.
Well, first of all, also Herod would not kill a baby.
Okay, so just the physical, in the moment, we have to save our lives. But what was the other more spiritual, symbolic reason that they went to Egypt?
Fulfill prophecy.
And so what can we deduce between that prophecy being fulfilled for a reason and Israel being called the son and Hosea prophesying about it? What's the bottom line connection I think that we need to make? To me, it's this. Jesus is the true Israel.
God always provides a way of escape if we're obedient to Him. So the Israelites escaped bondage. The life of Christ was saved by going to Egypt, and He saves our life if we're obedient to Him.
So. I think that we can connect Jesus to several themes in the book of Exodus. The first one is, what does Moses serve as in the book of Exodus? He is the lawgiver, and he's also the deliverer. So I believe that Jesus, as Moses was, was the deliverer, and later on the lawgiver as well. As I mentioned here, he is the true Israel. We find that in Matthew. God gives specific instructions for the building of what in Exodus?
Tabernacle.
Matt, could you read John 1:14? What did the children of Israel eat when they were in the wilderness? Manna. And we know that John 6:35, that Jesus is that true manna that feeds them, and that He was also the Passover lamb.
John 1:14, you said?
Yeah.
And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth.
And we'll get into this more next week, but the purpose of building this tabernacle was what? Why did God want them to build a tabernacle? Yes, we know that they needed to worship, but ultimately, what was the purpose? I wasn't thinking of it. Huh?
A way to God?
Yeah, I think it was access to God. He wanted them to build this tabernacle and inside have this most holy place so that He could dwell with them on earth. It was a way for the children of Israel to have access to or relationship with God in the Old Testament. How is it today that we have that same access to God? Again, we're trying to make these connections.
Through Christ, we have a way to God.
Yeah, absolutely.
Without Christ, you nothing.
Yeah, so that's kind of why I had this tabernacle listed, is that you had to make a way to have access to God. And the Old Testament was tabernacle. Today, that is Jesus Christ. So He is our tabernacle. Couple other themes here. Punishment for sin. How do we see punishment for sin show up in the book of Exodus? Who gets punished? Let me start with that question. Who gets punished for sin in the book of Exodus?
Those that rebelled and partied while Moses was up on the mountain.
So the children of Israel that were rebellious were punished because of that, and their punishment was they would never make it to the promised land. They would die out in the wilderness. Who else gets punished?
Moses does.
Moses is punished for taking credit.
And Aaron, I guess.
Yep. And then the other kind of obvious one is the Egyptians are punished for the way that they treated God's people. So another thing kind of to the nature of God is that God will make things right. And He is just. And every sin will receive a just payment or punishment. How about the law? Want to touch on this for a minute. What was the purpose of God giving the law?
And think New Testament.
What do we find out in the book of Romans and several other places from Paul? What's the whole purpose of God giving the law to the children of Israel?
Is it to expose sin?
That's exactly what I think it comes down to, is that without sin... without a law, how are we supposed to know if our actions are right or wrong? And the law was perfect in its time and its place. And because the law was perfect, and you apply that against imperfect people, what it does is it exposes our sin. If our sin is never exposed, we're never made aware of it, are we ever going to change?
No.
We're not. We're not. So the purpose of the law was to expose our sins so that we would know that we have to do something about that to rectify the relationship that's been fractured with God. And Exodus talks about, you know, how that sin issue was dealt with. Other thoughts about the law or the purpose from a large context?
I think an extension of what you just said, Romans 5:20. Moreover, the law entered that the offense might abound, but where sin abounded, grace abounded much more. So it was to expose sin, but I think the law also existed to show how inadequate we are and how unable we are to live up to the righteousness of God on our own.
It's almost like the more you know, the more you're tempted to do wrong.
God didn't only give the spiritual law, He gave all the civil laws also. It was all one, and all of that was for the good of man. In other words, you know, how they dealt with one another, if they had problems with one another, God had laws, commandments on how to deal with everything. And Moses was the judge, originally the first judge over all of that. And so all the commandments God gave to them, whether they were physical laws or spiritual laws, were for the welfare of man.
So before we close, again, Exodus just, you know, it lays out the Ten Commandments. We're going to get into some more of these civil and detailed laws next week a little bit more. You know, a lot of those commandments deal with our relationships with other people. We've got some with our relationships with God. The other thing I wanted to put on here, one of those Ten Commandments was to remember the Sabbath and keep it holy. What kind of implications does that have for us today as Christians?
Meeting together is altar work. Meeting as a family or as a unit.
Yep.
So set aside a day of rest and remembrance of Him.
Okay.
I'd say another thing too. Jesus said Sabbath was made for the man, and man was not made for the Sabbath. So the lesson there is that God's laws are for our benefit.
There's a reason that God made a day of rest, and there was a reason that He patterned rest for us. Was God tired on the seventh day after creating all the heavens and the earth? No, He wasn't tired. He set a pattern and example to say, this is a special holy day that I have set aside and made for you, and you're to use that to honor me, God Father. All right, so next week we'll get into the back half. We'll look at the tabernacle a little bit more in detail, and we'll wrap up the book of Exodus. But a lot of good themes for Christians today that come out of this book. Appreciate your comments.